super organism. But over time, James Lovelock and his many collaborators, including the American biologist Lynn Margulis, they refined their ideas, they clarified what they were talking about. And the modern evolution is to think of Earth as an interconnected living system. It's not a superorganism. It's actually the largest known living system. It's one big interconnected system in which all the animate and inanimate parts are working in concert. And it is analogous to, smaller but complex living entities like ourselves. We also are these jumbles of the animate and the inanimate. You know, most of our bodies is actually inanimate water and mineral and such, and then we only have so many actual living cells and tissues, but it all works together as one big system. So that's how I've really come to think of Earth, is that, it's a vast, interconnected living system. It's really life on the scale of a planet. You know, that's what it looks like when a whole planet comes to life.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Alex continues with Ferris Jabert, author of Becoming Earth.
Back in 2009, I spoke with Dr. Peter Ward from the University of Washington. He criticized the Gaia concept, publishing a counter theory called the Medea hypothesis. Ward would probably accept that a new overarching operating system, if you will, has appeared on Earth, but not that it has any purpose. Do you need to have a purpose in order to have Gaia?
I don't think so. And I think that's one of the things that's been clarified over time, is that in the beginning, Lovelock put too much purpose, too much agency, too much teleology into Gaia, and over time realized that that was not necessary. You know, that's not really how evolution works. We don't have to be working towards some sort of explicit goal. It's more of an emergent phenomenon. You know, there are certain physical and chemical conditions in place. Certain things are possible, certain things happen, and this results in astonishing complexity and beauty, but there isn't necessarily some explicit goal or driving purpose behind it all.
Well, before speaking to you, I reread my copy of James Lovelock's original 1979 book, Gaia, A New Look at Life on Earth. Lovelock criticizes environmentalists at the time for their focus on their own industrial societies. He suggested the real places where Earth's environment pivots away from current life will be found in marshes and coastal shelves, as well as underreported changes in the tropics. What are your thoughts about that? I mean, the latest science that I'm finding says that's probably true. That is where the action's taking place.
Yeah, you know, Lovelock was such an interesting character. He was a real maverick scientist, and he published a lot of different views over his lifetime, some of which contradicted each other. You know, his first book on Gaia was just his first, and he ended up publishing a whole series, and he, you know, had this real evolution of thought. And when it comes to his opinions on environmentalism and industry, there's definitely some contradictions, you know, embedded in there in the overall literature. But I think on the whole, we see that he absolutely accepted the reality of climate change, that, you know, the fossil fuel industry was what was driving climate change. And he was really interested in this idea of, you know, how can we sort of apply the concepts of biology and medicine to the planet as a whole and think about how to help the planet heal, how to help the planet recover from this shock, this crisis that we had forced it into. And I do think there's still something useful about that, because I do think that, you know, the planet is this immense living being, and we have pushed it into this crisis state, and it has recovered from such crises many times in the past, but it always takes a really long time to do so, and in the process, many, many species can go extinct, and obviously that is not something that is compatible with modern human civilization. So our task right now is trying to figure out how to help our planet recover much more quickly and much more safely, so that it does not enter one of these, you know, extremely unstable recovery periods that we probably will not survive.
Do you have any suggestions on how to bring the public realization that we are a part of life, not separate, that we are tiny parts of a planetary thing?
Well, that's really, you know, one of the major tasks that my book is engaged with, and I hope that that kind of science writing can help people understand. You know, one of the most personal ways in which I engage with this has been through my garden. Gardening became really important to me in the course of writing this book, and when I'm out there, I can really feel a visceral connection to the planet in a way I couldn't before. I think it really forces you to slow down and pay attention and really, you know, observe the minutiae of a single leaf or blade of grass or these tiny micro communities and ecosystems that really exist all around us.
Ferris, what are you watching and working on these days?
I have been working on a series of climate change articles for the New York Times Magazine, where I'm a contributing writer. I published one earlier this year in which I went to Australia to spend some time with scientists who are looking at changing the weather above the Great Barrier Reef as a way to potentially help the corals endure the warming and bleaching that they've been suffering from. So these scientists are trying to generate fog and brighten clouds to reflect more light and heat and cool down the water for the corals. And then more recently, I've been looking into the issue of ocean acidification and carbon dioxide removal and, you know, the latest thinking from the scientific community on these subjects.
And so how do our listeners follow your work?
My website is just my name, ferrisjaber.com, and I list all my articles there, and they can look out for my work in the New York Times Magazine. And I'm also on social media. I'm active on Instagram and Blue Sky under my name as well.
And Jaber is spelled J-A-B-R, so it's ferrisjaber.com. From Portland, we've been speaking with author and science journalist Ferris Jaber. You can check out his book, Becoming Earth, A Journey Through the Hidden Wonders That Bring Our Planet to Life. And you can also find further discussion in my own weekly blog at ecoshock.org.
Radio EcoShock.
Most of us know someone who reached a breaking point. They may go through an abrupt change of circumstances. Natural systems like ocean currents and polar ice can also shift quickly, with consequences around the world. We would like to anticipate fast changes, but early climate models could not predict shifts taking place in less than a decade. Multiple climate systems could undergo abrupt shifts. That comes from a new study using 57 worldwide climate models in a warming world. The lead author is Sjoerd Tepstra, a PhD candidate at the Institute for Marine and Atmospheric Research. That's at Utrecht University in the Netherlands. The open access article was published in AGU Advances June 23, 2025. From Utrecht, Sjoerd Tepstra, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
So abrupt shifts in the world around us sound pretty scary. How did you and your colleagues define abrupt shifts?
Yeah, so abrupt shifts are indeed quite high impact events. They denote big changes in subsystems of the climate. And how we defined it is as a sudden and large change that is substantially faster than how a system normally changes. So if you look, for example, at Arctic sea ice, with climate change, you expect a decline in the sea ice cover. And that's actually also what we see. And this we would call a relative gradual decline. However, if it undergoes an abrupt shift, you expect that a very large part of the sea ice cover will disappear within a few years or up to a decade. So these are really like high impact, large changes that reorganizes the system and brings it into a new state.
We've had expert guests on this program in the past say models were unable to predict large scale but short time duration events like the disappearance of the sea ice in 2007 in the Arctic. How did your group overcome that barrier?
Yeah, indeed. It can sometimes be difficult to detect these events in climate models. There are sort of two parts to this answer. So some of the changes we've seen in parts of the climate and also in sea ice where we had a sharp decline in some years, were not always as persistent. So sometimes they partially at least recover. And we really look at abrupt shifts that are persistent. So what this means is that after a decade, or actually multiple decades, we would still find the system in this like new state. That's one part. And the other part is that many of these climate models over the decades have been improved. New processes have been added. They've get better input data. So over time, they are better able to capture these phenomena.
Talk to us about the range and rate of warming you considered in this study. Was it as fast as today, and did you consider even greater warming that might come in coming decades?
Yeah, we used a special experiment. So the model set that we're using are the so-called CMIP-6 models. And these are the latest generation, like state-of-the-art climate models that incorporate as many processes as possible. And these are also used to inform the big IPCC report, so the big climate report. And they all do the same experiment. And one of them is experiments where the CO2 levels are increased every year by 1%, starting from pre-industrial. So what this means, they start with climates around, let's say, the end of the 19th century, and then quite aggressively increase the CO2, and they do this for 150 years. Now, what this means with this 1% is actually you force it a lot. So after roughly 50 to 60 years, you're already at the CO2 levels we are experiencing now. And what this allows us to do is to look at a wide range of warming in these models to really capture as much of the future climate as possible.
Now, there was a 2021 IPCC chapter titled Weather and Climate Extreme Events in a Changing Climate, and that was in the sixth assessment report of the IPCC. Now, did your work change or build on that?
I think it's also partially adjacent to this work. So this chapter is really about extreme events, and extreme events are also quite big abrupt changes. But the big difference is that they're often short-lived. So, for example, if you look at wildfires or at droughts or at extreme rainfall, the frequency of these events may increase, but there's no like really a different persistent state that you achieve. But we really look at if a whole system really changes. So, for example, if part of ocean circulation suddenly stops, or if a big part of the sea ice suddenly disappears. Interestingly, though, is that also in the next IPCC report, there will be a more specialized chapter that will also more explicitly talk about these high-impact, persistent uplift shifts.
We should clear up short any confusion between tipping points, which are pretty widely known, and the abrupt shifts that you were talking about. What are the similarities and differences here?
Yeah, they're indeed quite confusing concepts because they're actually quite highly related. So abrupt shifts, as I said earlier already, is a real fast and sudden change in the system. But that's all. That's all the requirements there are. You have also systems, they are called tipping elements, that can undergo tipping. And these are more systematic, qualitative changes in the system. And what happens if they reach their tipping point? They reach sort of a critical threshold where suddenly the system reorganizes itself. So, for example, if you have global warming as sort of a forcing of a system, if you reach a certain level of it, you suddenly change the system. So it's really a short tipping period. In addition to that, we have some type of irreversibility when a system undergoes tipping. And what this means is that once you're past this point of no return, past this tipping point, you cannot really bring the system back to where you wanted it to be beforehand. So if we take, again, the sea ice analogy, if it would undergo a tipping point and it would fully melt, you cannot just reduce the global temperature to the levels before this tipping point because the ice would not regrow yet because there is not enough freezing capability. So we really need to bring the whole climate back way more in the past to actually recover many of these systems. And that makes it so difficult to deal with them once you pass this point of no return. And often when they do tip, they can undergo an abrupt shift. So often they change quite abruptly, but it's not necessary.
What subsystems did you investigate? Could you just give us a quick list?
Yeah, We focus on a few different systems. One are the sea ice systems in the Arctic and in the Southern Ocean. We also looked on the land at the rainforest in the Amazon and the boreal forest. We looked at permafrost, so permanently frozen grounds in the Northern Hemisphere. And we focused on some part of the ocean circulation, which is the North Atlantic Supologia.
Before we dive into specific cases, in a couple of places in your new paper, it appears that two or more abrupt shifts could develop at the same time. We could get a big shock. Short, is that likely, and is combined system change more likely as the planet warms?
Yeah, it could indeed be possible that multiple systems undergo such an abrupt shift, either simultaneously or one after another. We do find in quite some model simulations that this does occur. It's not really clear how independent they are, if they are independent of each other or if one can cause another. This is still a relatively new area and something we're actively working on to really see, like, for example, if part of the ocean circulation would abruptly stop, what would then the effect be on precipitation over the rainforest? Or what would the effect be on the sea ice? This is still a very active area of research, but it is possible that multiple of these events would occur in one situation.
We expected slow, orderly warming just going up on a ramp. Most of the charts showed a ramp, but climate change may change in jumps. Does the rate of warming affect appearance of abrupt shifts?
Yeah, so what we do see in our results is that models that warm faster have more abrupt shifts. Partially this is due to the fact that our model simulations are all the same length of 150 years, and some models in that time period warm more than others, which means that if you reach higher temperatures in these models, more of the subsystems are at risk for abrupt shifts. However, it is unclear if there is really some type of instability caused by higher rates of warming. It could be that if you warm something faster, the system becomes more unstable, but we did not find explicit evidence of that, and that would really need more research.
Well, let's look at a couple of systems that you did analyze. One is the North Atlantic Gyre of the Atlantic Ocean. Is that the same as the Gulf Stream or AMOC, and what did you find?
The North Atlantic Supologyre is part of the AMOC, but we do see them partially as different systems. So this AMOC is, let's say, the conveyor belt of the Atlantic Ocean. It brings warm surface water towards the north, and northern Atlantic, it actually sinks because it's quite dense water, and then at death, it will return as cold water to the south. So it's this big northward heat transport that dictates much of the climate in the northern hemisphere, especially around Europe. Now, the North Atlantic Supologyre is one of these locations where this AMOC water sinks to the bottom. Now, what happens with climate change is that this AMOC weakens, so the amount of sinking reduces and this whole system starts to slow down. And what we now find is that the Supologyre, as one of these locations of sinking, might actually abruptly stop with the sinking or the convection of this water. Even if this would occur, part of the AMOC might still flow. So they're partially different systems, but they're highly connected. And what we did find in the Supologyre is that in a third of the models, we find indications of stop of convection, so stop of this circulation, and it occurs between around half a degree Celsius to 2 degrees Celsius of global warming. So it is quite a wide range, but it's definitely slightly on the lower end of some of the expected temperature ranges we find.
Signs of a collapse in the subpolar gyre include a decline in sea surface and surface air temperatures. Now, how is that possible in a time of relatively rapid global warming?
It's quite a unique location where there is a so-called warming hole, where there is very little warming or even cooling. And it has to do with the function of this AMOC of heat transport. If the subpolar gyre shuts down or if the AMOC starts to slow down, there is less heat transport towards the north. There's a lot of cold water coming in from the northern side. So you get locally cooling down of the area. So this is the area, let's say, below Greenland. And this can fully offset, or at least partially offset, global warming.
Why is permafrost thaw considered a possible regional tipping element, but not a global one?
Yeah, this is an interesting system. So permafrost is frozen ground that is permanently frozen. It occurs in the northern hemisphere, so around Canada, but also a lot in Siberia. One reason that we see this as a more regional tipping element is because if locally the permafrost thaws, you might get some type of feedback of increasing temperatures that might also tell the surrounding permafrost. But it's quite difficult to actually translate, to move around to other parts of the globe. Moreover, part of the permafrost is on different latitudes, so some is more polar than others, which means they're also exposed to different temperatures. This together leads to that you find lots of localized places where you find abrupt thawing in some models, but you would not find this if you look globally. If you look globally at permafrost thaw, you would see a quite gradual decline.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Dutch scientist Sjoerd Terpstra about abrupt climate change, a very serious subject. After investigating models and narrowing down to those that do include vegetation, your team doesn't seem to find a good basis to evaluate abrupt shifts in the Amazon or boreal forests. Now, these are well-known concerns with the global public. Why did you feel you had to leave them out, so to speak?
Yeah, this really has to do with the limits of the methodology. So we're indeed aware that these systems are at risk for quite abrupt disappearance. However, with the edge detection method we are using, we're not able to capture changes in vegetation as well as in other systems. And that's because these variables, these land variables, like vegetation, leaf cover, they behave a little bit different than some others. And this makes it challenging to detect shifts in them. However, we do know that in this same set of models, in the same set of experiments, they actually do occur. So we find a few of them, but also there's another study from Pari and others in 2022 where they explicitly only looked at this Amazon rainforest. And there they did find that out of the set of models that represent vegetation well, that the majority, around 90%, 80-90%, show abrupt disappearance of part of the Amazon. And this goes from around 0 to 40%, depending on which model you're looking at.
One of the biggest fears for over a billion people in Africa and India would be if the monsoon rains watering their agriculture were to stop. Is that possible, and what did your new assessment find?
Yeah, changes in the monsoon could have quite severe impacts. In the CMF6 data, we do not really find any abrupt changes in the monsoons. There's only one example in one model where we find a slight northward shift of the Indian summer monsoon. But it's only one out of the 57 models, so we don't find any strong evidence for this. Also, we have quite strict criteria of what we would call abrupt. And we do know that monsoons might change with climate, although it's, I think, still a little bit unclear in what way. But we do not find the same type of shift as we do see in some other systems.
The 2023 Global Tipping Points report from Tim Lenton and his colleagues said it was unclear whether Antarctic sea ice goes through abrupt shifts. Now, I find that hard to believe because the southern sea ice experienced an abrupt decline starting around 2015 and taking less than 5 years. We just talked to experts like Edward Doddridge about that. Isn't that an abrupt shift?
Part of this is indeed definition. What would you call a big enough area of sea ice disappearing? Enough of an event to really call it an abrupt shift. But at the same time, there is still quite a lot of discussion and uncertainty surrounding whether Antarctic sea ice is either a tipping element or whether it can undergo abrupt shifts or not. What I can say is that in the CM6 models that we do find some of these shifts in a certain set of models, we find around 11 out of 57 models that have some abrupt shift in Antarctic sea ice. The interesting thing here is that it's quite dependent where you look at. around Antarctica. So there's not any single event that we detect in any of the models where the sea ice all around Antarctica disappears in one go. We do mainly find two locations where it locally disappears. One is in the southern Atlantic section, and the other one is more on the Pacific side of the Antarctic continent. And there we do find quite large-scale abrupt shifts.
Your new paper does not predict the year or even the decade when an abrupt shift will take place. Why not? And what gauge did you use?
This is because we used a scenario where we increased the CO2 by 1%, which is way more rapid than we're currently emitting CO2. So we could not use the year of simulations as an accurate prediction of a year or an accurate assessment of the year in which the shift happened. That's why we linked them to the global temperature they occurred at. So we looked for each abrupt shift, what is now the global warming in this model compared to pre-industrial. And that way we can still make an assessment of what future climate you would potentially get such a shift. In the meantime, there are some other assessments looking at more realistic scenarios. These are called SSP scenarios, and they make use of the historic emissions and predicted future emissions based on expected emissions. And there they find similar results as we do with abrupt changes in, for example, the sea ice.
With 57 different climate models running, each with their own data and operating assumptions, how many agreed that abrupt shifts in climate will happen and become more likely as we overheat the planet?
So we find that in 48 models, we find at least one abrupt shift. And in 44 models out of 57, we find even more than one. So this does show that these models are capable of creating abrupt shifts in the climate and that it becomes more likely as we continue the warming. And some of these shifts happen at relatively high temperatures, up to 3 to 5 degrees of global warming. But we already see a risk around 1 to 1.5 degree that in some systems and in some models, we can already see abrupt shifts occurring.
How can we use information about abrupt shifts, and how does this research move forward towards better and better predictions?
So what this research adds is that we look at the newest set of climate models, the CMIP-6. This type of assessment has also been done on the previous generation of models, and this way we can partially compare of what the models do now, but we can also show that these models are capable of this abrupt shift, and that it's a risk that we should take seriously. Now, we did quite a general overview, so we didn't delve specific in each system with all the mechanisms of this shift happening. So hopefully this also informs other research where they can more explicitly look into the specific feedbacks that are happening and what the real likelihood is. And on the other hand, it also signals that it's important that we take into account that this could happen. Right, it doesn't show that it will happen, but that it could happen. So in some places in the world especially, it could be important to take this into account when planning future climate scenarios. The likelihood is really difficult to pin down, but especially on a regional scale, right, if you look at about single continents or part of continents, this can have quite severe effects on top of the expected climate change. And I think this also calls, like so many other studies, for the importance of cutting emissions and halting climate change before we get into more and more risky areas.
From the University of Utrecht, we've been speaking with climate scientist Sjoerd Terpstra. He led the new paper, Assessment of Abrupt Shifts in CMIP-6 Models Using Edge Detection. It was published June 23rd, 2025. Find links to all the news and science we talked about in my show blog at ecoshock.org.
My name is William, and you're listening to CJSF at 90.1 FM in Burnaby. CJSF is diverse, independent, and yours. Uniquely curated programming by our hosts maintains an independent voice among the masses. You keep CJSF independent.
What is the forest industry most afraid of? Shifting the conversation from saving old growth to protecting what's left of BC's primary forests, areas with minimal human disturbance and far greater ecological value than tree farms. Save What's Left Conservation Society is a volunteer-run group at the forefront of the movement to save the last remnants of unprotected primary forest through seeking reforms to the government agency, BC Timber Sales. Learn more at savewhatsleft.ca, find us on social media, and please support our vital work through our website.